Good morning. Welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Chilton, your co-host today, Mike Rouse. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning, Hugh.
On today's programme, we'll be talking about the MPF. The Financial Services Development Council has produced a report on some of the strengths and weaknesses of the retirement scheme after some two decades of operation. It's proposed, among other things, that employees contributing to the MPF fund should be given tax incentives to encourage more contributions, that an EMPF scheme should be set up to streamline administration, and that more high-risk asset classes should be introduced. Well, what do you think of their proposals? After 20 years, what changes would you like to see to the MPF? Let us know your thoughts. You can leave a message on our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. You can email us, backchat@rthk.hk, or you can give us a call on 233 88266, 233 88266. After 9:20, we're talking about Donald Trump's national emergency. Joining us for our first topic, we have with us now Francis Chung, who's Executive Chairman of MPF Ratings, which is a private company providing research and advice for MPF providers and for consumers. David Webb, who's a shareholder activist and founder of website.com. We hope to be joined soon by Bill Tang as well from the FTU, member of the Labour Advisory Board and a former legislator representing the Labour functional constituency, and also a member of the working group from the Financial Services Development Council will also, we hope, be joining us after the news at 9 o'clock. Mr. Chung, maybe good morning to you.
Good morning.
I hope I described your company accurately. So you're in the business of doing research and thinking about MPF from day to day. Taking a little step back from that and thinking about kind of the 20 years, how would you say the MPF scheme is doing? Do you agree with some of these proposals that have been put forward? You know, what would you do to improve the scheme?
Look, that's a good question.
It's a big question.
MPF is 18 years old. It's almost 20. But from my experience with teenage and a 20-year-old child, there's really not much difference between the 2 years. Look, no system is perfect. But at the same time, I guess we have a view that any mechanism that encourages savings is a good thing. So first, there's a concept to encourage savings. MPF is a positive strategy. The idea to offer tax incentives, again, the view that we would take is that any strategy that encourages savings, particularly for the long term, for retirement, has to be positive for the people and the workers of Hong Kong.
Okay, so you agree with that proposal?
Yeah. Look, whether it's to encourage savings through tax incentives, through providing better education and advice, anything that encourages members to save for their retirement is a good thing.
You sound a little bit half-hearted, I've got to say. like it's not that bad. It's doing a good thing because it's supporting savings, which is good in principle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
could it be done a lot better?
Look, as I said earlier, anything could be done better. No system is perfect. I mean, I read the report and it referred to contributions. contributions within Singapore, CPF, about high contribution rates, high savings rates there. I think what is overlooked there was the system was established in 1955. And for the first 13 years of CPF, total contributions were 10%. And where are MPF contributions today at 18 years old? It's 10% in total. So I think there's a lot of negative press out there on MPF. I'm not sure that that is necessarily completely justified. As I said earlier, no system is perfect, but a system that encourages savings and encourages extra savings for retirement, and if you can provide incentives for members and, in this case, the workers of Hong Kong to do so,
well,
we would say that's
okay,
a positive
thing. Put it like this. I mean, you deal with a lot of people, say the consumers, like many of our listeners, who have MPF schemes, and they want to know, presumably from you, where to put the money and so on. What's the sort of common complaint? What do they want? What do they say to you about the MPF?
Yeah,
feedback?
Look, most of our MPF ratings business model was established 7 years ago now, going into our eighth year. And the reason why we established MPF ratings was that essentially it appealed to sort of the partners of MPF's moral compass. We sort of realized that there were 2.7 million workers out there with MPF accounts, yet there was really nowhere for them to go to really understand the true value of the MPF scheme that they had and whether they were in in inverted commas, a good, average or below average scheme, because the schemes at the very beginning were offered to the workers by the employers.
Mm.
So from our perspective, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to sort of bring out and educate not only the workers of Hong Kong, but also the very employers that chose those schemes in the first place, actually what they chose. And what we found is that in reality, I guess, if you ask employers quite honestly, you know, why did they choose the MPF scheme that they first chose, they couldn't tell you. You ask an MPF account holder which MPF scheme they're in, they kind of scratch their heads. And I think part of it is that contribution rates have been so low for so long, they thought it was an incidental component of their total wealth. But the reality is the average MPF account now is 300,000 Hong Kong dollars. If you're a married couple, that's 600,000 Hong Kong dollars. In my native tongue, that's over 100,000 Australian dollars. In US dollars, you know, you're talking about $70,000 or so. I mean, that's, you know, it's not a small amount of money now. So, and we found this in Australia as well, that that members become interested in their retirement accounts when that sum of money becomes a meaningful amount of money, and it's becoming meaningful.
Why? Well, what about this fundamental criticism that why were employers the ones choosing the accounts for their staff? Why, if this is my retirement money, why am I not the one choosing?
Look, it's difficult to speculate on that. I mean, it was a while ago. I mean, look, again, I mean, the irony is quite often the Australian system is put up as a paragon of positivity, and they're going through a Royal Commission now on financial services, and superannuation is at the forefront of that. But at the same time, contribution rates there are now, I think, 9%, heading to 12%. And initially, it was actually an employer-sponsored situation, but they now have full choice, the equivalent of full ECA here. We've got semi-ECA. Inevitably and hopefully we will get to that full choice environment. So we'll move away from that conjecture.
Because it was widely suggested that employers were choosing banks and with whom they had other relationships.
Well, it was based on the bank that gave you the best kickbacks, basically.
David Webb.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
good
I was
morning.
Tiptoeing around that one. Good morning, David.
You know, what I'd say to that is that, yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, from what we've seen is that there is a very high correlation between market share and distribution capability, so banks and insurance companies. And then if you look at the way that we rate schemes, gold, silver, bronze, and you look at the market share, there is a disproportionate, an inverse relationship between market share and gold-rated funds. So yeah, I think, look, at the end of the day, in financial services generally, whether we're talking
about... You're saying that the smaller MPF providers are more likely to be of a higher quality, more likely to give a higher return?
I wouldn't make that generalization that smaller
MPFs... Isn't that what you were saying with the inverse relations?
I wouldn't say sort of explicitly. What I'm saying is there are some smaller schemes that offer genuinely good value for money for members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and they're not being chosen for whatever reason.
Well, they probably don't have the distribution capabilities of some of the larger providers.
Than the banks and so on. Okay, David Webb, good morning to you.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. I think you'd agree with Mr. Chung that the scheme is not perfect, is that right?
Well, the best improvement you could make would be to abolish it. You know, it's time to admit...
To be fair to Mr. Chung...
To
be fair to Mr. Chung, that's not kind of his consideration, is it?
Put him out of a job.
He's talking about, I guess, making the best of the architecture.
I'll make a point there with David saying that it would put me out of a job.
Yeah.
I humbly say this, I don't need this as a job, you know.
Well, then do something better with your life, because, you know...
But I am terribly passionate about ensuring that the workers of Hong Kong
make the best of a bad situation. Yeah, I mean,
generate the best possible value for money out of the system that they're in.
Social engineering at its worst. It's patronising in the extreme to tell Hong Kongers they don't know how to save and they must be forced to save. There are two things going on at the moment. Some of what's in this paper is already happening anyway in its own slow way. The eMPF, for example, is a good thing. If you're going to keep the MPF, this will reduce its administration costs by having a centralized platform for the distribution and allocation of payments. and choice of funds and so on. So the EMPF is happening, but the earliest
and that will stop all the little when people change jobs and they get little schemes and so on.
Well, that only if you legislate other things as well. But the main concept is to reduce the duplication of effort and paperwork that goes on in the system at the moment by having it all centralised with a single login. You as an employee will log into the EMPF and decide from month to month, if you have that choice, to redirect your payments to a different fund.
Okay, you agree with that. Okay.
So if you're going to keep it, that's a good thing. But the earliest part of that, the chairman of the EMPF recently said, would be in 2022, and that's in phases. So it's going to take years and years before it's up and running. I can imagine that the banks will be kicking and screaming and complaining about the costs of integrating with the system and making their computers talk to the EMPFA's computers and so on. And the government is also there's already a bill in LegCo proposing a $60,000 salaries tax deduction, up to $60,000 for additional voluntary contributions. Now, do the maths. That's $5,000 a month. If you're earning less than $50,000 a month, which 90% of the population is, according to the Census and Statistics Department, then that's more than 10% of your income additional allowed into the EMPF. So, in fact, that takes you up to 15%, which is what this paper is proposing anyway. It's more than 15% if you earn less than 50,000. So what the FSDC is saying is let's have that deduction above 50,000 for high earners. The top 10% of the population that earns more than 50,000 a month would be allowed to put in tax-free an extra 10%.
What is the justification for giving more public money to the richest people?
That's right. So it's basically a tax subsidy. It's a subsidy from the government. If you're on the highest income tax band, of salaries tax band, of 17%, then for every $83 that you put into the MPF, they'll put in $17 up to an extra 10% of your salary. If you're earning $2 million a month or $2 million a year, say, let's be honest, more realistic figure, $2 million a year, then you could put in $200,000, of which $34,000 will be paid by the government and $166,000 by yourself.
So, welfare for millionaires.
Yes, that's what the proposal is, basically. So I think it's a non-starter for that reason. But
you said there's a bill
really,
here.
You should not be trying to force people to engineer their choices by giving them deductions for one thing or the other. Just give them their income, net of salaries tax, after a reasonable allowance for the cost of living, at a flat rate of salaries tax, not all this gimmickry that we have right now, 2%, then 6%, and so on, and let them spend it how they wish and save it how they wish, because there isn't any free lunch in this. What it actually is, the MPF is mandatory payment of fees, and you'll be paying fees at the average rate of 1.5% per year of your accumulated pot every year until you retire, which when you're 20, that's another 40 years of fees ahead of you. And if you look at the takeout of the industry in the last 18 years, the total expense ratio has come down slightly from 2% to about 1.5% per year. But basically about between a quarter and a third of all of the gains on the fund have evaporated in fees over that period. Leaving a net return of about 4% per year. If you were to say to people, we admit this whole scheme was simply to enrich fund managers, we're going to abolish it and let you choose what you do with your savings, many of them would go out and buy stocks in the market. They would buy tracker funds on various indices, which have a total expense ratio of 0.1% per year compared with the 15 times that you pay through the MPF. Or they might buy more property or put down deposits for their children's flats or invest in their children's higher education. There's all sorts of things that you might do with the money that you are basically restricted from doing by the MPF.
All right, lots to talk about there. Let's go to Marianne Kong, who's a member of the MPF working group for this the council who produced this report, Financial Services Development Council. Ms. Kong, good morning to you.
Good morning.
thank you very much indeed for joining us. Let's talk a little about the tax then that David Webb was touching on there. This is one of the proposals to encourage more contributions. They say there should be tax incentives for employee voluntary contributions to a maximum of 15% of income when combined with mandatory contributions. What's the thinking there? How would that work, and how do you avoid the problem that David Webb was talking about?
Thank you for your questions. I really appreciate, you know, the opportunity to have a discussion around this. Obviously, there's a lot of debate going on generally in terms of, you know, how to improve a system. But I think but generally is I would totally agree with Francis' comments in terms of any encouragement, incentive to try to you know, to improve savings, encouraging people to save. I think it's always very welcome. But just to put things in context, because I think David is very much referring, you know, to a specific group of a population, I think one of the key observations is the MPF system is really for, it's almost like a one-size-fits-all, right? So I think that's where the key issue is, that, you know, you can't really cater for all the different levels of the working populations, right? So given all the restrictions that's in it. And I think that's what we're trying to address. So obviously, in terms of this tax incentive, right? So that's seen as potentially a way to encourage savings. So the tax incentive is meant to be more on voluntary contributions. So so just to be clear that, you know, it's not meant to basically force people to, you know, to invest more. In a way, so it is our recommendation is read on the voluntary contributions. But to come back to the 15%, how we came up with 15%, at the moment, employers' contributions to retirement schemes, they can be tax deductible up to 15%. So that's why, to align with that, that's why we came up with this proposal of 15%, so that both employees and employers' contributions can have the same tax deductibility level, right? So I think that's basically the background to that 15%.
David Webb?
The employer's deduction is because it's an expense to them. They're paying an employment expense. Whether they spend it on salary or on contributions to the MPF, it still costs them money. It's a total cost of employment that matters to an employer. So it's not a fair comparison. From the employee's point of view, if you are, say, a banker in Hong Kong, about to be reposted after your next three-year term, you might be sent off and permanently leave Hong Kong, then you will put in, out of your $2 million salary, you'll put in the maximum into the MPF because you know you can cash it out when you permanently leave Hong Kong, whatever age you are. So it becomes a tax avoidance mechanism to be able to divert some of your savings, your income temporarily into the MPF, and then withdraw it again. And if you retire early at 60, you can do the same thing. So anyone who's approaching the age of 60 to 65 would rationally avoid tax, whatever their income level, by stuffing as much money as they can in temporary, because they only have to pay the excessive MPF fees for a short period of time before they can get it out again.
Okay, how would you avoid that, Marie-Anne Kong?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, the detailed implementations, I mean, you always need to think about making sure that, you know, there's no abuse of the tax exemption being provided. But you can't assume that everybody will think about tax loopholes.
Well, no, but generally,
before,
why should the government? Generally, why should the government subsidise high earners' savings by saying we're going to exempt you from tax on that as much as you save up to 10% of your income?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense to me that, you know, welfare is needed for the poor in Hong Kong, not for the rich.
Yeah, tax exemption that we're proposing is not unusual in many countries.
It doesn't make it right, does it?
So I think, you know, we are trying to think in terms of, you know, what has been practiced elsewhere and what Hong Kong could potentially learn from other more mature economies where a pension system is a bit more mature, right? So incentive is clearly something that needs to be thought of. So giving the tax incentive is one way.
Okay, let's look at the, there are other angles as well. And we're also joined now, as I mentioned, by Bill Tang from the FTU, former legislator. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, what do you think, looking at 20 years of the MPF and this proposal, this report, do you agree with the recommendations? How would you improve the MPF in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think the most concerning point is the real and the actual expense of MPF. So many economists or the banker always say, oh, you see, the ratio is actually decreasing. But
the management fee or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I mean the fee, yeah, the expense. But the FER. But when we calculate in actual and real the amount of expense, 10 years ago, around 4 billion and 50 million a month. But nowadays, is over 30 billion. Okay, what we see is because of the inflation, because of the higher and higher cost, or just the big and bigger profit, it's a very concerning. The real and actual amount,
the percentage, expense. I think that people say as a percentage, it's gone down.
I know
is that true?
Yeah, it's true. Maybe so many banker or so many the financial industry, they will think it's normal. But we will have a comparison like in Mexican. The government can have a power to say no and stop any increase of the private pension fund management fee. But in Hong Kong, because it's applauded by the policy, by law, it's compulsory. We see it's not acceptable, the higher and higher fee. And even the MPFA is saying every 1% management fee or any 1% expense, they will deduct the actual accumulation of fund in 20%. So it's quite harmful to the employer.
I think the key message is when one of these providers buys the book of business of another provider, they're spending a lot of money to do it. It must be a profitable investment that they're making.
But you see, why there's the expense is bigger and bigger in 200% in two times over 10 years. I think it's not reasonable.
Right.
And the most concerning point is why we are now the MPF service provider earn so much, and furthermore, we do not know the distribution of such expense. For example, we know the operation of MPF is administration and investment, but actually we do not know the proportion of the expense. So the governance of the MPF trustee, I think, is most concerning. So,
okay. Francis Chung, you wanted to come back on that?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I think Bill makes a very good point about fees, but I'd like to also perhaps sort of suggest an alternative view as well. Firstly, I think sort of if you look at the magnitude of fees over time, look, they're a function of assets under management. The industry's 18 years old. Assets have grown, so obviously the total absolute fee is greater. MPF Ratings view is somewhat pragmatic. We're kind of agnostic in terms of fee levels, provided members are getting true value for money. Okay, one of the things that we are less agnostic about, and we've been sort of pushing the industry on for many years, and we do focus on governance, and that's another area we can talk about separately. But one of the areas of governance for us isn't so much the level of fees, but as Bill mentioned, the transparency of fees. And what you'll find now, and again, to be fair to the MPFA, they're starting to push this to all the scheme sponsors and trustees, is disclosure of the transparency of fees. So I think in our latest survey for our latest ratings, we identified out of the 17 scheme providers, there are at least 7 or 8 now in their principal brochures that break down their total fees between the trustee, the administrator, the actual fund managers and also distribution costs. So to the extent that the expense ratios, let's say that David mentioned, was say on average 1.5% now, yes, I would agree with Bill. Transparency of that is absolutely important, particularly when you have sort of same organisation sponsored trustee management administration sort of entities. You want to know where that money's going, and in most cases, and the trend is they're all beginning to be far more transparent, you will see that.
Well, they were forced to. Okay. I mean,
we've got a break for news at 9 o'clock. We can follow up on that. And also the question of whether there should be higher risk elements as well. That's been proposed as well. We're talking about the MPF this morning. Do chip in by emailing us, backchat@rthk.hk, or you can give us a call on 233-88266 if there's something you want to say. Later, we're also going to be talking about Donald Trump and the wall with that declaration of emergency. We'll be talking to an academic in Virginia. Again, if you want to comment, backchat@rthk.hk is the place to do it, and we'll read out your messages. The weather now before the news at 9. It's going to be cloudy today with a few showers and some showers and isolated thunderstorms later. Temperatures up to about 20 degrees. Still unsettled tomorrow morning. Sunny periods in the following couple of days. 17 degrees now. Humidity 94%. Welcome back. This is Bank Chat on a Monday morning, first one of the week. We're talking about the MPF. This is following a report from the Financial Services Development Council that's available online. We have a member of the MPF Working Group who produced that, Marie Anne Kong, with us this morning to talk about it, along with Bill Tang, a member of the Labour Advisory Board on the employee side, a former legislator from the FTU, David Webb, a shareholder activist and founder of website.com, and Francis Chung, who's executive chairman of MPF Ratings, a commercial company providing research and advice for MPF providers and for consumers. Later we're going to be talking about Donald Trump and the declaration of emergency. If you want to comment, please email backchat@rthk.hk put something on a message on our Facebook page. That's Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. Maybe we'll get to the emails in just a moment. Marie-Anne Kong, another of your suggestions, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, this is not in the report, but something that you had mentioned in interviews, was to bring some higher risk classes, some higher risk kind of things into the MPF scheme. What's the thinking there?
Okay, so you know, thank you for the questions. I think, so first of all, if I could just put this in context, right? So it is a recommendation in the report. So first thing is the five recommendations that we put forward is meant to basically, first of all, before you can actually increase the level of assets and encouraging people to save more, we do recognize that some fundamental aspects needs to be fixed. So the five recommendations really been organized in such a way that we believe that, first of all, we need to improve members' engagement. So that's why the EMPF is one of them. You know, the comprehensive advice proposals is one is the other one. Before we finally get to all the incentives and the encouragement to improve the asset size. And broadening the asset classes and the investment options is one of them. So it is not necessarily a higher risk that we are proposing, but it's really just to broaden the investment restrictions, right? So at the moment, MPF contributors can only invest in approved pooling investment funds, which are approved by the MPFA. So it is not the whole authorized funds products in Hong Kong, you know, which is generally available to the retail public. So as part of thinking about broadening the investment options, so one of our recommendations is basically to consider, whether it is necessary to have a separate subset for MPF funds versus other funds which are already available to retail
public. What's excluded at the moment that you might want to include then?
So for example, a lot of the ETF and the REITs products are currently not in that pool, right? So the MPF pool, there are some markets, for example, like China market, which are also not part of that pool in terms of MPF, right?
Thing that's missing, Marie-Anne, is the ability to allow people who think they can manage their own money to do so and to pick stocks directly rather than being forced to pay fees to fund managers. You're proposing new kinds of funds to be should be allowed, but you're not proposing let people buy REITs directly or buy the Tracker Fund of Hong Kong or make time deposits or whatever they think they want to do. Within the ring fence of the MPF. They can't withdraw the capital, but they should be allowed to have self-managed MPF funds, don't you think?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point. And I would say that it's been debated very lengthily. And David
well, it's not
very,
in your paper.
No, but David's very right. I think if you were to try to put together a lot of recommendations that came out, that paper... There's no way that we will be able to issue it.
I think it's one more paragraph.
So
you could replace one of the things that was already happening with
a
recommendation that people be allowed to open a stockbroker account and pick their own stocks with their MPF money.
Yeah. So basically, so that was clearly an aspect that we did debate, but we wanted to basically come up with some pragmatic proposed solution which can work within the current system. Right.
So, well, the current system is a captive to the fund managers, though.
After 20 years, you don't want to say that you want to scrap the MPF completely, right?
So I think I think governments do have to admit when their policy decisions have been wrong, even if it's 18 years later.
Right, being able to move forward and try to see about how we work within the system.
Bill Tang, I mean, the things you've been talking about are kind of, I suppose, to do with fairness, the question of the management, the question of transparency.
Yeah.
Do you want to get more? Do you think basically the scheme is a good one? You want to encourage more people to join the scheme? And if so, how would you do that?
I know that last year, MPFA have a campaign that introduce what called a governance chapter with all trustees, but I think such chapter actually is not a legal binding. We asked, especially I was a legislative councillor, even in legislative council, I want the actual amount of expense of different trustee, and now there is 14 trustee. I want such a number. Actually, no such reply. The MPFA say they have no power to make it in public. So I think, to be fair, that for public monitoring, every trustee, they should be open their actual amount, especially in the very detailed breakdown, for example, the proportion of management, the proportion of administration, investment.
Do you want more people to give more money to the MPF?
Yeah. We see, for example, the Australian, the total contribution is 9.5%, but all contribute by employer, not employee. So in Hong Kong, the total amount is not enough. But if we see just encourage the employee pay more is not fair, because we see it's a responsibility of employer. For especially we see the salary level, especially the grassroots, is very low. It's not enough in after the retirement. We have a proper retirement life.
There's two fundamental points here, aren't there?
Yeah.
You want to know who's getting the 1.5% and for what, and then you also want to put more of the burden on employers.
Yep, I see. Now the Hong Kong employer, the unexpected the output is not the because of the salary, but the rent. So what we see a big map index the legal minimum range in Hong Kong actually is lower than Taiwan. Lower than Singapore.
Okay, we're getting off topic, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. But I just see the total welfare of employee in Hong Kong is not high. So actually, we have no Pillar One retirement.
This proposal to provide the government subsidy for savings is just that, and it carries the implication that people are not saving outside of the MPF with the cash flow that they do have at the moment, and they are. But they're not going to be given a tax deduction for saving their own money privately in the stock market or in mutual funds or whatever. Instead, they're saying, if you give it to us, the MPF,
why we put our money in MPF because it's not promised.
Yeah, and also, not only that, but the government's latest legislation, which you will be considering, are you still a legislator or you were?
No,
but
no,
your former colleagues will be considering, that they also want to bring the insurers in on the game by allowing deferred annuities and having a $60,000 tax deduction if you put the money into an insurer's run deferred annuity, paying profits to the insurers and hidden fees to them as an alternative to the MPF. Well, that doesn't really take us very far forward. I can understand why the FSDC, which really seems to be captive to the industry, to me, has not proposed allowing people the choice of managing their own investments and avoiding 1.5% per year of fees and perhaps just paying modest brokerage commissions to choose long-term holdings of the stocks.
All right, we've got quite a few emails to share as well. Thank you very much indeed. Backchatter.hk.hk is the address. Michael says, the allowed contributions need to be fully tax-deductible. Given Hong Kong's small population and the limited size of the MPF pool, there should be just one provider mandated by the government, i.e. Vanguard, Blackstone or DFA, and the government should limit their fees. A larger, more experienced manager would also improve fund offerings, index funds, more diversified holdings, small caps, REITs, value growth, etc. There needs to be more information available to investors, what the funds hold and basic financial information, modern portfolio stats, to allow investors to evaluate the offerings. Investors should have one account that they take from job to job, not multiple accounts. Some thoughts there from Michael. Joe Average says, many years ago in the UK, we had something like 33%. This paid for the government, for roads, for hospitals, for pensions, and it worked until we started receiving people from other countries. It would be more appropriate for the government to make higher tax and everybody receive a government pension. Therefore, we would eliminate all the parasites, all the scams in the banking systems. When I look at two MPF accounts that I have, the banking system is a joke. One is okay. The other, High Street Bank, they certainly haven't done things in my better interest. Why is it the government think we all want to be gamblers and sit there watching the stocks and shares? The MPF is only tailored for the wealthy because it's already negotiated by the wealthy, and the wealthy probably don't have much money in the MPF, have their money elsewhere. X says, I just got my MPF. Yes, I hit that age. My feeling, about time I got my and my employer's money back with virtually no gain. I did so much better with the Singapore scheme when I worked there and my American IRAs. Sorry, but the MPF is a rip-off. So by contrast, I got a message from Stuart, who says, David Webb is spouting his usual nonsense to rubbish the MPF and propose changes to it, especially the offer of greater tax benefits for AVCs up to $5,000 a month. There is no point in rubbishing the MPF unless there is a viable alternative offered. Further, given how this subject has been treated as a political football in LegCo, there is little or no prospect of there being a totally new product created to replace it. Further, the major issue is that without MPF, many employees, especially those in the lowest income levels, will be left with no provision being made towards their retirement benefits. Thank you very much indeed for those thoughts. Once again, email address is backchatter.ehk.hk.
I'm not proposing tax deductions, to be clear. That was the Financial Services Development Council.
Actually, David, you and I were both querying the justification for...
For the whole scheme?
I have trouble here. I'm trying to be neutralish.
Okay.
But I have written that it should be scrapped.
But there is a perfectly viable alternative, which is called free choice. It's allowing people to save their disposable income if they wish.
And
many of them will.
I think the concern is that left to their own devices, most people don't save enough.
Right. And
well, history tells otherwise. If you look at the amount of accumulated savings, the people who could afford to have bought property when they could and have become very wealthy off the back of that, if they'd been forced to put it into an MPF system in the 1970s, maybe they'd never have got to that stage. So, Free choice works. And for those who are unable to save because of their low income levels, there will always have to be, and there should be, a social welfare safety net for them. And we can afford to do more in that area if we don't spray the money around needlessly on subsidising the savings of rich people.
Well, can I just say something, Mike and David? Look, this issue about free choice, at the end of the day, MPF is not going to disappear. So, in my view, it's a futile argument to say, let's just...
Why not? It appeared in the first place by legislation. Yeah, you can legislate
it
away.
It's not going to disappear, all right?
Just you wait.
Okay, shall we put money on this? How much time do you want to put
so
on?
So much Western interest.
What I will say about free choice is, again, just put this example, put MPF, the MPF environment aside. And I thought this was pretty gutsy of this particular MPF scheme sponsor, and I'll name them. It was Sun Life. Sun Life last year did an analysis of all their customers. Again, just put aside that it's MPF, okay? We're talking choice here. They can choose. Did an analysis of all their customers to identify who made money, how they made money, who lost money, and how they lost money. And they identified the customer group that lost the most money. So they did a bit of research.
On their savings?
On their contributions, yeah? On their MPF balance.
Oh, only on MPF, not on the other Sun Life products?
On MPF.
Right.
But again, just it doesn't matter that it's MPF or not. It's dollars, okay? And they're investing.
Well, it
and
does,
they've got, and they've got free choice to switch, doing whatever. And the reason why they were at the bottom rung of wealth creation, in fact, they destroyed their own wealth, they had their own choice they could choose, was because they invested in asset classes at the wrong time and switched too often. And that's the problem. And I get that we could just give Hong Kong workers the money and invest for themselves. But I'm not sure they're actually equipped and capable of making sensible
investment decisions.
Giving
them the money, it's returning decisions. Their income. I mean, they already earned it. We're taking it away from them, so giving it back, if you like. But, you know, this old trope that the average Joe public makes bad investment decisions is probably not true if you look at the overall scheme of things. It's just that people remember their losses perhaps more than they do remember their gains. In the overall sum, it's the whole market. And even if there is some underperformance by people who are overconfident about their own investment-making decisions, surely it's better to give them that choice than to force them to hand it over and pay 1.5% per year to someone else who won't necessarily make much better decisions to overcome that cost. About a third of all of the returns on the MPF in the last 18 years have evaporated in fees, as I said earlier. And the total expense ratio that you see of 1.5% doesn't include the transaction costs on stocks either, that the actual funds buy, because those are embedded in the prices and the gains and losses that they make.
All right, couple more comments. One, first of all, from S, who says, isn't the whole purpose of the MPF to have a sure way of saving? Why are your hosts suggesting some risky investments? It seems like people are drifting into some risky areas.
Well, you have a sure way of saving.
That comes from S.
Independently.
A different S. Stuart says, another point to make. If the level of contribution to MPF is increased, members as well as employers will take greater ownership of the scheme and begin to make proper use of it, says Stuart. Marie-Anne Kong, is that your thinking? Do you think that if people would... Because, you know, you can offer all this advice and this transparency and this extra information and so on, and education I know you talk about and things like this. But I think a lot of people are kind of not very interested and not very engaged by their MPF at the moment. Do you think that if they, you know, if they were told to give more money, that they would become more engaged?
Yeah, so totally agree with you there, right now, in terms of like the lack of engagement. So I think what we're proposing is we have to fix a number of things first in order to improve that engagement before people really want to, with or without tax incentive, want to contribute more, right? So at the moment, you know, there are already some pension schemes available in Hong Kong, like the ORSO schemes, where employees don't have tax incentives, right? So it's the same tax deduction that we have as MPF, but yet we hear of so many examples where employees voluntarily want to contribute more to some of these also schemes because they've had a good experience with the schemes, right? So that's why we came up with this idea in terms of really trying to think about how to improve the engagement in MPF, similar to what is already happening with some of the other pension schemes, in order to really encourage people to want to save with or without an incentive, right? So I think that's basically the point of it. It can be debated lengthily in terms of, you know, how much that incentive should be, but the key here is really how to improve members' engagement, right? So we all recognize it is a good thing, but it has to work for everybody. And so I think, you know, I would really encourage, you know, more people to voice out in terms of how to improve things as opposed to necessarily wanting it to go backwards.
Okay, and one more comment from X, who says, who was talking about the comparing with the Singapore and American schemes, and she says, and by the way, my US security, social security will be hugely better. Well, thank you very much indeed for everyone this morning, to Marianne Kong there, who's a member of the MPF Working Group from the Financial Services Development Council, who produced this report, to Bill Tang, thank you very much indeed, from the FTU, to David Webb, a shareholder activist, and Francis Chung, executive chairman of MPF Ratings. Thank you all very much indeed for joining us this morning.